out along either side of the appliance. After a moment, I saw her shut her dark eyes. The metal piping that served as the toaster's innards heated to a glowing red. A long black cord dangled near her feet, unplugged. The cheap little thing only lasted another minute before its inside started to melt together. I made her put it down at the first sign of smoke. "See?" she seemed to be saying. "Get it?" "But you can't do that to me," I said, reaching for her hand again. "You don't have to worry about hurting me, because you never could." "I know how it feels," is what I really should have been saying. "I know what it's like to be scared of what you can barely control." I had forced myself to stop thinking about what I had done to that undercover PSF. I didn't let myself wonder if I could do it again, let alone test it out. But how, I wondered, were either of us ever going to learn to control ourselves if we couldn't practice, if we couldn't stretch and test boundaries? "Let's see if we can find something useful," I said, slipping my fingers around hers again. I waited until I felt her hand close against mine before leading her back down the aisle. "What do you think?" I'm not even sure what I was about to ask her, but she wasn't paying attention to me. Zoo stopped so suddenly and gripped my hand so damn hard that I stumbled back a few steps. My eyes followed the line of her outstretched arm to the upended clothing and shoe racks. More specifically, to the lone hot pink dress dangling from an otherwise empty rack. Zoo took off at a run, blitzing down the aisles of extension cords and buckets. I tried to keep up with her, but it was like the wind had caught her heels and was propelling her forward. She stopped just short of the rack. I watched, fascinated, as one of her hands reached out to stroke the fabric, only to pull back at the last second. "Beautiful," I told her. The dress itself flared out at the waist, with a big ribbon bow at the place where the sleeveless top met the pink and white striped skirt. She looked like she wanted nothing more than to pull it down, hug it to her chest, and press her face against the satiny fabric. I could think of about 1,000 things I missed while I was at Thurmond, but dresses were not on that list. My dad's favorite story to tell strangers and indulgent relatives was the day he and Mom tried to button me up into a blue one for his birthday party when I was 3. Because the buttons were so small and impossible for me to reach, I shredded the fabric by hand, bit by gauzy bit. I spent the rest of the party proudly parading around in Batman underwear. "Are you going to try it on?" I asked. She looked back up at me and shook her head. Her hands dropped from where they were hovering over the plastic hanger's shoulders, and it took me a moment to recognize what was happening. Zoo thought she didn't deserve it. She thought it was too nice, too new, too pretty. I felt a sweltering hate rise in me, but I didn't know where to direct it. Her parents for sending her away? Her camp? The PSFs? I pulled the dress off the silver rack with one hand and took Zoo's arm in the other. I knew she was looking at me again, her dark eyes wide with confusion. But instead of explaining, instead of trying to force her to understand the words I wanted to say, I led her over to the dressing rooms in the center of the clothing section, thrust the dress into her hands, and told her to try it on. It was like tugging a boat into dock on a thin line. The first few times I handed it to her, she would put it down and I'd have to pick it back up again. I don't know if her desire finally won out or if I'd managed to exhaust even her wariness, but by the time she appeared, peeking out from around her dressing room's door, I was so relieved I almost cried. "You look amazing." I turned her back around so she could see herself in the room's tall mirror. When I finally coaxed her to look, I felt her shoulders jerk under my hands. Saw her eyes go huge and bright, only to droop again a moment later. Her fingers began to pluck at the fabric. She was shaking her head as if to say, "No, no, I can't." "Why not?" I asked, turning her so she was looking at me. "You like it, right?" She didn't look up, but I saw her nod. "Then what's the problem?" At that, I caught her sneak another look at herself in the corner of the mirror. Her hands were smoothing the fabric of the skirt, and she didn't seem aware of it in the slightest. "That's right," I said. "There is no problem. Let's see what else we can find." After, she wanted to find something for me. Unsurprisingly, the adult section had been decimated by looters, My choices seemed limited to hunting gear and industrial jumpsuits. After several patient explanations about why I didn't need the silky cornflower blue nightgown or the skirt with daisies on it, she, with a look of total and complete exasperation, accepted that I was only ever going to try on jeans and plain t-shirts. And then she pointed to the bra rack, and a part of me wanted to crawl under the discarded piles of kids' pajamas and die. The letters and numbers might as well have been in Chinese for how much sense I could make of them, and I half expected Zoo to start laughing when the first touch of frustrated tears welled up in my eyes. There were not many times I'd stop and think, "I wish Mom were here." I understood now, at least, that what I had done to her, I could never fix. She would never look at me again and recognize me, and I would never be able to think of anything other than the look in her eyes when she saw me that morning. It was strange how my feelings about her seemed to change by the minute. That one moment I could remember what it felt like for her to brush my hair, and the next, be furious that she had abandoned me. That she hadn't taught me how to live in my own skin and be a girl, like she was supposed to. But whose fault was that, really? Zoo's lips puckered in thought, her eyebrows knitting together as she surveyed the Everest of undergarments in front of us. She began to pluck one of every size, tossing them back toward me until both of us were laughing ourselves silly for no real reason at all. Eventually, I found what I thought might have been the right fit for me. It was hard to tell. They had all been so damn uncomfortable with their wires and pinching straps. While I changed out of my dress, Zoo happily pulled together an outfit for herself that looked like something out of a store catalog. The pink dress, white leggings beneath it, and a jean jacket that was one or two sizes too big for her. The rest of the things she found were stuffed into a flower-patterned backpack I pulled down off a display for her. Now that she had found her own things, she wanted to go the whole hog and pick out things for the boys, too. When I found her a new pair of tennis shoes with rosy laces, she actually wrapped her arms around my waist and hugged me, like she could squeeze the thanks into me. And while Zoo was not especially impressed by the pair of short black boots I found for myself in the men's section, she didn't try to force any of the ribbon flats or towering high heels on me. Zoo was in the process of neatly folding a button-down shirt she had chosen for Chubbs when I remembered something. "I'll be right back," I told her. "Wait right here, okay?" It took me a few minutes to find the aisle again. Liam and I had walked past it so quickly as we made our way toward the back of the store, I wasn't altogether sure that I hadn't imagined seeing them. But there they were, just above the cleaning supplies. A pair of bright pink rubber gloves dangling amid a sea of traditional yellow ones. "Hey, Zoo!" I called as I made my way back to her. I dangled them out in front of me and waited for her to turn around. When she did, her mouth actually fell open. She was so dazzled by her new gloves that she walked with her hands stretched out in front of her, the way a princess examining the collection of fine jewelry around her fingers and wrists would. I watched her curtsy and twirl in her new dress as we lapped the store, all the while her feet dancing over the evidence of what had happened at the checkout lanes. Watching her, feeling the exhilaration swelling in my chest, I couldn't say I was all that aware of the broken glass and flickering monitor displays either. We turned down the dimly lit corridor of cosmetics, and I could barely keep the grin off my face. Liam found us there a short while later, just as Zoo was tying off the braid she'd woven in my hair with a glittery hair tie. I sat on the tile and she sat on the shelf behind me like some fairy queen. "Magnificent," I told her when she held a broken mirror out in front of my face. "You are incredible." And my reward for that was the feeling of her arm's bird-like bones twining around my neck. I twisted around so that I was facing her, because I wanted her to see my face. I wanted her to see how serious, how sincerely I meant it when I repeated myself. "You are incredible."
"You two have been busy, I see."
Liam leaned against the aisle's end cap, eyebrows raised. Zoo bounded toward him, scooping up the shirts and socks she'd picked for him.
"Thank you. Oh, God, Chubbs is going to piss his pants when he sees this."
His hand came down to rest on top of her head.
"Geez. I leave you two alone for a little while and you clean out the joint. Good job." I pushed myself up off the floor, helping them gather up the clothes and supplies we'd managed to scrounge up. That done, we started our slow, reluctant shuffle back to the others. All three of us seemed to be aware that once we left that peaceful moment, it would be behind us forever. Zhu had only just darted out a few steps ahead of us when Liam turned to me and said, "Thanks for doing this. I'm glad you got what I meant." He gave my braid a little playful tug. "I just wanted to ask them a few more questions." "And you didn't want," I nodded toward Zhu, "to hear?" He looked down at his feet, and when he looked back up, his ears were pink. "Yeah, but also, you were kind of distracting them."
"What? I'm sorry I threatened them or whatever, but..."
"No distracting them," Liam repeated, "with your face."
"Oh." I recovered quickly. "Did you get anything useful out of them?"
"The names of a few of the friendlier tribes, a few cities under lockdown for insurrection, stuff like that. I just wanted to get a sense of what was happening in Virginia."
"I meant about the slip kid," I said, maybe a little too eagerly.
"Nothing we didn't have before. Apparently everyone takes some sacred oath not to reveal more information than that. Totally ridiculous."
"They really wouldn't give you any more information?" I said.
Liam looked down at the ground. "Greg made us an offer. A trade, but we turned him down."
"What did he want?"
"What was so valuable that they wouldn't trade it for the one thing that would reunite them with their families? Black Betty?"
"Doesn't matter," Liam said, and there was a finality in his voice. "If those numbnuts managed, I'm sure we can find East River ourselves. Eventually."
"Yeah," I said with a light laugh. "True." Out of the corner of my eye, I watched him hoist the pile of clothes onto his shoulder, his gaze never leaving where Zhu was hopping and skipping through the field of cans and old magazines. I glanced down at a blonde movie star's face as we passed it, my eyes falling over the words, "She finally tells all," printed under her face.
"Can I ask you something?"
"Of course," he said. "What's up?"
"Why are you looking for the slip kid?" I asked. I felt his eyes on me, and I knew what explanation was coming.
"I mean, besides wanting to help Chubbs and Zhu get there, and trying to deliver Jack's letter.
Is it because you want to go home, or..."
"Any reason in particular you're asking?"
His voice was even, testing.
"The questions you were asking them about the camp," I explained. "It just seemed like you were trying to figure something out."
Liam didn't reply for a long while, not until the tents they'd set up for the night were in sight. Even then, it wasn't an answer.
"Why do you want to find the slip kid?"
"Because I want to be able to see my grandmother.
Because I need to understand how to control my abilities before they destroy everyone I care about."
"But you didn't answer my question."
Zhu dashed through our tent flap, and the lantern in the tent lit up Chubb's delighted face. When she handed his new things over, he folded her into an enormous hug, lifting her off her feet with the force of it.
"It's the same as you," he said. "I just want to get home."
"Where's that?"
"See, that's the funny thing," he said. "It used to be North Carolina, but I'm not so sure anymore."
We stood staring at each other for a moment, nearly toe to toe, and when he lifted the flap of the tent for me, I couldn't help but wonder if he had picked up on my half-truth as easily as I had picked up on his. 16. It was an hour, maybe more, before Liam's breathing evened out and he began to snore. He slept flat on his back, his hands resting against the soft flannel of his shirt. His face, which earlier had seemed marked by old, bruising shadows, looked young again. He might have been able to pass as a 20-year-old with his facial scruff and solid build, but he didn't fool anyone while tucked away in sleep. His face was turned toward Zhu, who slept between us under a mountain of blankets and was currently the only thing that was keeping me from inching closer to him, from slipping my hand under his bigger one and learning the contents of his dreams. But the distance between us was there for a reason. imagining a future in which I didn't exist, in which I had unwittingly erased myself from his memories, kept my hands pinned under my legs, and my mind, for once, in check. When I heard Greg and his pals stir in their tents next to ours, I finally gave up all pretense of sleep. Their voices began as a low murmur, indistinguishable from one another, and grew louder as the minutes ticked by. Finally, they turned their lantern on to the lowest setting, just enough to be visible through our own green tent's shell. I slipped out the other side of the tent, careful to keep my footsteps soft against the concrete. Their whispers grew in volume and urgency the closer I came. "Them?" Greg mumbled. "We don't owe them anything." My hands clenched at my side. All of the anxiety and distrust that had been swelling up inside of me over the past few hours coming to a head. For a single second, I wished that I had brought my backpack inside the store with me. The panic button was there, waiting to be used if the situation blew up fast and ugly. Stupid, Ruby, I thought. Stupid. I wasn't worried about taking care of Greg and his friends. Even with their guns, we still had a chance. But if they tried to pull something while we were asleep, or if they called in reinforcements? My feet stopped mid-stride. Chubbs had beaten me to guard duty. He sat facing the tents, his long, spidery legs crossed in front of him, and Zoo's workbook in his lap. He was leaning toward the others' tents, concentrating so hard on picking up their conversation that he missed my approach and nearly jumped out of his skin when I appeared.
"Zoo?"
He squinted in my direction.
"Zoo?" I whispered back. "Really? I mean, really."
I took Zoo's workbook and pencil out of his hands and flipped the page without looking at whatever he had been writing. "What are you doing?" I wrote, showing it to him. He rolled his eyes and refused to respond when I tried to put the pencil back in his hand.
"Do you think they're going to try something?"
After a moment, he sighed and finally nodded.
"Me too," I scribbled. "Come with me?"
By the way his shoulder slumped, Chubbs seemed to think he didn't have much of a choice. He stood quickly and quietly, wiping his palms against the front of his khaki pants.
"I have a bad feeling about this," Chubbs said when we were out of earshot.
The tents were in our line of sight, but we weren't in theirs.
"About them."
"Do you think they're going to try to rob us?"
"I think they're going to try to take Betty, actually."
There was a long pause. I felt Chubb's eyes slide over to me, but my own were fixed on the tents, watching for trouble.
"You should go back to sleep."
There was a gruff edge to his voice as he crossed his arms over his chest, but there was also something about the way he said it that made me wonder if he was waiting to see what I would reply.
"What are you even doing up?"
"Same as you, I guess," I said, "making sure no one gets brutally mugged, beaten, or murdered in their sleep. Watching to see if those kids are the assholes I think they are." Chubbs snorted at that, rubbing his hand over his forehead. It took some time in silence, but I felt the air between us ease from a guarded hostility to something that felt to me like acceptance. His shoulders were no longer bunched up with tension, and when he tilted his head toward me, I saw it for the subtle invitation it was. I took a step closer.
"It was bad enough he had to come back here?"
Chubbs mumbled, more to himself than to me.
"God."
"Liam?" I asked.
"This is where he and his friend were captured, right?"
Chubbs nodded.
"He's never told me the whole story, but I think what happened was that he and Felipe were traveling and ran into a tribe of blues. Instead of recruiting them like Lee hoped, the tribe beat the hell out of them and stole everything they had. Food, packs, family pictures, you name it. They came here for a few days to regroup, but they were in such bad shape that they couldn't get away when the skip tracers finally showed up."
Something hard settled in my throat.
"Lee thinks that that tribe probably called them in," Chubbs continued, "that they got a cut of the reward."
I didn't know what to say. The thought of a kid, of any of us, turning against our own kind made me want to smash the shelf we were leaning against into a heap of metal.
"I trust Liam," I said slowly. "He's such a good person, but he's so easy for others to read, and they don't have the best intentions."
"Exactly,"
Chubbs said. "He's so busy looking inside people to find the good that he misses the knife they're holding in their hand."
And even then he'd probably blame himself for the person having the knife to begin with and apologize for being such a tempting target. That was what troubled me the most about Liam. If he was any more trusting and good-hearted, he would have been a Boy Scout. It was either an amazing feat of stubbornness or naivete, I thought, for someone who had seen so much death and suffering to still believe so unconditionally that everyone was as stand-up as he was. It was something that inspired both exasperation and a fierce sense of protectiveness in me. And Chubbs, too, it seemed.
I think we both know he's far from perfect, no matter how hard he tries, Chubbs said, settling himself down on the ground and leaning back against the empty shelf. He's never been a big thinker, that one. Always rushing to do whatever his gut tells him to, and then drowning in his own self-pity and guilt when things blow up in his face.
I nodded, absently fiddling with a tear in the sleeve of my new plaid shirt I hadn't noticed before taking it. After hearing Liam with Zoo, I knew that he felt an intense guilt over what had happened the night of their breakout, but it sounded like it might run even deeper than that.
I can fix that for you later.
Chubbs nodded toward the torn fabric. His long fingers were splayed out over his knees, tapping against the bones.
Just remind me.
Who taught you to sew, anyway? I asked. Apparently it was not the right question to ask. Chubbs' back went stiff and straight, like I had dropped an ice cube down the back of his shirt.
I don't know how to sew, he snapped. I know how to stitch. Sewing is for decoration. Stitching is for saving lives. I don't do this because I think it's pretty or fun. I do it for practice.
He stared at me over the rims of his glasses, waiting to see if I got what he was trying to say.
My dad taught me how to stitch before I went into hiding, he said finally, in case of emergencies.
Is your dad a doctor? I asked.
He's a trauma surgeon.
Chubbs didn't bother to hide the pride in his voice.
One of the best in the D.C. area.
What does your mom do?
She used to work for the Department of Defense, but got fired when she refused to register me in the IAAN database. I don't know what she's doing now.
They sound great, I said. Chubbs snorted, but I could see him warm to the compliment. The minutes dragged by, and the conversation waned. I found myself reaching for Zoo's notebook and flipping it open to the beginning. The first few pages were mostly sketches and doodles, but those gave way to page after page of math problems. Liam's handwriting was neat and precise, and, surprisingly, so was Zoo's. Betty traveled 118 miles in 3 hours. How fast was Lee driving? You have 5 Snickers bars to share with 3 friends. You cut them in half. How many will each friend get? How can you make sure the leftovers get shared equally so Chubbs doesn't complain? And then I got to a page with completely different handwriting, messy and smeared. The letters were darker, as if the writer had been pressing down on the paper too hard. I'm not sure what else can be said about this book that hasn't already been said. I'm out of clever things to say, I'm afraid. Jonathan Swift has always been a favorite, but I can't get over how clever his wordplay is throughout the novel. I really can't get over how similar it is to Robinson Crusoe at times, especially when he's on the ship to Lilliput. Though his interaction with the Lilliputians wasn't the strongest section, you would be hard-pressed to find equally clever interplay of parody and originality. I can see why the book has been studied so carefully by scholars over the years. We meet Gulliver as a dreamy young man in search of adventure, trying to get anywhere that would involve sea travel, and see him evolve masterfully. If I had to name the best section of the book, it would probably be the Lilliputian section, a place I would greatly like to visit, because my own head is often stuck in the clouds, and to be able to study philosophy and mathematics all day, a dream. There was a time or two over the course of the novel that I felt Swift had gone overboard and missed some opportunities to drive home his idea of what the ideal society should be. You, as the reader, are left to figure it out for yourself. This book is perfect if you love thought-provoking literature from an objective, rational viewpoint, or if you dream about one day traveling the world yourself. I held the page up for him to see.
This yours?
Give me that, he said. His face was wild with panic. Not just panic, By the way his nostrils flared and his hand shook, it was almost like I had scared him half to death. Guilt shot through me. I passed it back to him and watched him tear that sheet of paper out.
"Hey, I'm sorry,"
I said, worried about the tinge of green coloring his face.
"I didn't mean anything by it.
I'm just wondering why you'd practice writing essays when you said you didn't think we'd ever get to go back to school." He continued to stare at me for several seconds, until something in his stony expression finally gave. Chubbs blew out the breath he'd been holding.
"I'm not practicing for school."
Instead of tucking the sheet of paper inside the briefcase, he laid it out between us.
Before camp, my parents thought the PSFs were investigating them, which, you know, they were. They sent me up to my grandparents' cabin to hide, and you remember what I said about the internet being policed? We had to find a way around it, especially when they started putting pressure on Mom at work.
I glanced down at the sheet of paper again. "So you used to send book reviews?"
"I had a laptop and a few wireless internet cards," he said. "We would post book reviews online. It was the only way we could think of to talk without them catching on."
He leaned over, covering the paper so only the first column of words was visible. "I'm out. Can't get to you. Can meet anywhere. Name, place, and time. Missed you. Love you."
"Oh." "I wanted to write it out now," Chubb said, "in case I can get online, but only have a few minutes."
"You're pretty genius," I said slowly. "Your whole family." I got a snort in response. "Duh." The question I really wanted to ask him was inching its way up my throat when he pulled a deck of cards out of his briefcase.
"Want to play a few games?" he asked. "We're going to be here a while."
"Sure, but I only know Old Maid and Go Fish."
"Well," he cleared his throat, "we don't have the right deck for Old Maid, and, unfortunately for you, I excel at Go Fish. I won the Go Fish tournament in 5th grade.
I grinned, waiting for him to deal my cards.
"You're a star, Chubbs."
His nose wrinkled at the name.
"I can't call you by anything else if I don't know your real name."
"Charles," he replied. "Charles Carrington Merriweather IV, actually."
I tried to keep my face straight as possible. Of course he would be named something like that.
"Okay. Charles? Charlie? Chuck? Chip?
Chip?
I don't know. I thought it was kind of cute."
"Just call me Chubbs. Everyone else does."
I figured it out. It must have been 5:30 in the morning, well after several delirious games of cards and charades that had been brought on by too much candy and too little sleep. Both of us had been waiting for the other shoe to drop, to be proven right about the other boys. We kept the baseball bat beside us and never once turned our backs to the tents. When exhaustion finally set in, we took turns curled up on the ground, trying to steal a few minutes of sleep here and there. I picked up Zoo's notebook again in an attempt to avoid being lulled to sleep by Chubb's rhythmic snores, and added a few clouds and stars to the first page of doodles. The pages fanned out under my fingers as I flipped through the notebook again, not catching until I found what I was looking for. 540. It was an area code for this part of the state, I was sure of it. Grams had lived down near Charlottesville for a time, and I had a very vague memory of standing in the kitchen of my parents' house, staring at her number printed on a notepad beside the phone. But the area it covered, that was no small bit of land, and there was no real guarantee that it was supposed to represent an area code in the first place. It was easier to think of it now without three eager sets of eyes on me, but slightly complicated by the fact that I was running on fumes, sleep-wise. With more than enough time to kill, I started in again, rearranging them, trying to create anagrams, substituting different letters for others. The feeling snuck up on me slowly, crawling back up through the crowded, tired portions of my brain. The other number, 540, where had I seen that? Why did it feel like...
When it came to me, I almost laughed. Almost. I had seen the number on the radio in Greg's memory only a few hours earlier, burning brightly through even the murkiest clouds of his thoughts. It was 5:40 a.m., a radio station. Shaking Chubbs back awake wasn't enough for me, not when I thought I would actually burst at the seams with excitement. I all but pounced onto Chubbs' back, both scaring him senseless and kneeing him in the kidney in the process. I'm not sure what sound he made when I landed, but I was fairly certain it wasn't human. "Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!" I hissed, hauling him huffing and puffing and cursing to his feet. "When they gave you EDO, did they say anything else?"
"Green, if I can still walk tomorrow, so help me God,
listen to me," I hissed. "Did they say anything about tuning in or picking it up?" He fixed me with a baleful look.
"All they said was to check out Edo."
"Check out," I repeated. "Those exact words."
"Yes," he said, exasperated. "Why?"
"I was wrong before," I said. "I don't think the number has anything to do with a phone number. We were right before. The last letter isn't a letter at all. It was supposed to be a zero. 540. It's some kind of radio station."
"How in the world did you reach that conclusion?"
"Ah, the tricky part in all of this. How to BS the fact that I had cheated and seen the answer rather than being in possession of brain power to actually work it through. I was trying to think of what else uses three-digit numbers. When I remembered hearing them, Greg and the others, I mean, talking about needing to find a radio here. I should have mentioned it to you guys before, but I didn't think anything of it until now."
"Oh, my God."
Chubbs was shaking his head, mildly stunned.
"I don't even believe it. We have honestly had such shit luck this entire trip. I thought at least two of us were going to end up dead in a ditch somewhere before we figured it out."
"We need a radio," I said. "I think I'm right. But if I'm not, we need to test it before telling the others."
"Betty?"
"No." I wasn't about to leave the tent unguarded, even for 15 minutes. "I thought I saw a radio in the back. Let me go grab it." The store was rushing around me in dark streams and fading colors as I ran, but I wasn't afraid of what was lurking there. Not now. I hadn't imagined the radio after all. It was back in the small cluster of rafts and blankets that Liam and his friend had set up the last time he was here. Chubbs was pacing in front of the shelves by the time I got back. I set the small device up on a shelf that was about eye level and began to fuss with its buttons, searching for the on switch. I had to be the one to start it up, and the one to fumble with the volume knob when it just about blew our eardrums out with static. The thing was ancient, a beat-up silver box, but it worked. The speakers jumped between voices, commercials, and even a few old songs I recognized.
"It has to be AM. Chubbs said, taking the radio in his hands. "FM frequencies don't go up past 108 or so. Here we go."
My first thought was that Chubbs had somehow tuned it to the wrong station. I had never heard a sound like the one sputtering through the speakers, a low growl of static pierced by what sounded like a tub of broken glass being tossed around. It wasn't painful like the white noise, but it wasn't pleasant either. But Chubbs was still grinning.
"Do you know what this is?"
he asked, and was all too happy to explain when I shook my head.
"Have you heard that there are certain frequencies and pitches that only kids with a psi brain can pick up?"
I braced a hand on the shelf to keep from doubling over. I had. Kate had told me as much when she explained the camp controllers had embedded a certain frequency in the white noise to root out any of the dangerous ones still hiding out in the other cabins.
"It's not so much that others can't hear the noise. It's that their brains translate the sounds differently than ours do. Really fascinating stuff. They did some testing with it at Caledonia to see if there were any pitches that certain colors couldn't pick up and others could, and it always sounded like this when we couldn't."
No sooner had the words left his mouth than there was another sharp click, and the noise cut off altogether, replaced by a soft male voice whispering,
"If you can hear this, you're one of us. If you're one of us, you can find us. Lake Prince, Virginia."
that same message 3 times before it clicked again and switched back to the frequency we had heard before. For a long time, Chubbs and I could only stare at one another, speechless.
"Oh my God," Chubbs said. "Oh my God."
And then we were saying it together, jumping up and down, arms flung around one another like 2 damn fools, like we had never, ever wanted to reach over and slap each other multiple times on multiple days. I hugged him, without any kind of fear or self-consciousness, fiercely, with a rush of emotion that almost brought tears to my eyes.
"I could kiss you," Chubbs cried.
"Please don't," I gasped out, feeling his arms tighten around my ribs to the point of cracking them. Either by his internal clock or Chubbs' excited squeaks, Liam woke first. I saw him out of the corner of my eye, his head of tousled blonde hair sticking out of the tent. He looked between us once and retreated back into the tent, only to reemerge a second later looking torn between confusion and worry.
"What's wrong?" he asked. "What's going on?"
Chubbs and I glanced at each other, wearing identical grins.
"Get Zoo," I said. "You guys are going to want to hear this."
17. According to Chubbs, Jack Fields was the second son in a family of 5 kids, and the only one to survive idiopathic adolescent acute neurodegeneration. His father had owned an Italian restaurant, and his mother died of cancer when he was young. Jack was unremarkable in appearance, the kind of kid you would pass in a school hallway and not think twice about. But he was stealth cool, the only one in their room that knew what Liam was talking about when he started in on Japanese horror flicks or articles from back issues of Rolling Stone. Apparently, he liked to tell stories in weird voices and spent years scratching out a replica of New York City's skyline on the converted classroom's blackboards. The PSFs assigned to their room had been so impressed with the sheer detail of his work that they actually let him finish. More importantly, Jack took great pleasure in antagonizing the camp controllers by using his abilities to lift things off their belts and out of their pockets, or to throw things into their path so that they'd trip and fall in front of everyone. To hear Chubbs talk, you would have thought Jack Fields was a saint walking on earth, a disciple of awesome, preaching the proper way to use their blue abilities after spending years figuring it out for himself. Which was probably why he was the first one the camp controller shot in the back of the head the night the kids tried to make their escape. Liam was silent as we approached Petersburg's outer city limits, only nodding once or twice to confirm that the craziest parts of Chubbs' tale were true. He had been just as excited as the two of us when we dragged him over to listen to the broadcast, but slowly, over the course of a few hours, his mood had deteriorated. When Chubbs' stories died out, so did all conversation in the van. "It's supposed to be really beautiful there," I said suddenly, then winced at how awkward it sounded. "Lake Prince, I mean." Liam didn't look stressed so much as profoundly sad. That was what worried me, that he was sinking into something that not even our breakthrough could pull him out of.
"I'm sure you're right," he said quietly.
He handed me the half-folded map.
"Can you put this back in the glove box?"
I certainly hadn't been looking for it when I opened the small compartment, but there they were, nested on top of a pile of crumpled napkins. Truthfully, I had been expecting envelopes, or at the very least lined notebook paper, which was stupid and didn't make any sense because it's not like their camp had arts and crafts days. It's not like they were just given the paper and pens. Still, I had been expecting the letters to be something heavier, for Chubbs and Liam to be carrying theirs with them. Jack's letter was on top, written on half of what looked like a computer printout, folded over several times. He had managed to squeeze his father's name in tight capital letters on the back of the paper, between the large black words, "Area Restricted." Instead of putting the map away, I took the letter out, only vaguely aware of the argument Liam and Chubbs had gotten into over the best route to Lake Prince. I wasn't thinking much of anything as my fingers slid over the wrinkled surface, smoothing it out as I unfolded it. No date in the upper right-hand corner, just a hasty, straight-to-the-point, "Dear Dad." I didn't get to take in another word. Liam reached over and ripped the paper out of my hand, crumpling it slightly in his fist.
What are you doing? He demanded.
I'm sorry, I just...
You just what?
He barked. I felt my body jerk in response.
It's personal. It's none of your business what it says.
Lee, Chubb said, sounding every bit as surprised as I felt.
Come on.
No, this is serious. We don't read each other's letters.
Never? I said.
What if you can't find his dad and the letter has some clue about where he might be?
Liam was shaking his head, even as Chubb said, She has a point.
He said nothing, but his hands trembled on the steering wheel. It was his silence that stung, and when I couldn't take another second of it, I reached over and turned on the radio, sending up a prayer that an Allman Brothers song would be on. Instead, Betty picked up a news talk show.
Children are in containment for their own good, not just the safety of the American public. My well-placed sources in the Gray administration have informed me that all instances in which a child has been removed from rehabilitation early have resulted in their untimely death. There is simply no way to reproduce the routine of medication, exercise, and stimulation these rehab centers are using to keep your children alive.
Liam punched a knuckle against the volume button, trying to turn it off. Instead, the tuner jumped to the next available station, and this time it was a woman's voice delivering the bad news.
Sources are reporting that two Psi fugitives were picked up on the Ohio-West Virginia border traveling on foot.
Betty turned so hard and fast into the empty rest stop that I swore she did it on two wheels. Liam parked diagonally across three different spaces, throwing the brake on with a fast, "Be right back." 1 minute he was beside me, and the next we were watching the back of his red flannel shirt as he jumped over a puddle of stale rainwater and headed for the colonial-style brick building and vending machines.
That was... dramatic.
I turned to look at Chubbs over the seat, but he was just as confused as I was.
You should probably follow him, Chubbs said.
What should I say? Chubbs gave me one of his looks.
Really? You need me to spell it out for you?
I had no idea what he meant, but I went anyway, tracing Liam's trail of anger and frustration past the restrooms, past the abandoned sitting area, to the other side of the building, where there was wild, long grass, trees, and absolutely no way we could have seen him from Betty. He stood with his back toward me, sagging against the rest stop's wall, arms crossed over his chest, hair standing on end. I thought I was being quiet like a fox, but he knew the moment I stepped behind him. His grief hung around us like humidity, seeping into my skin. I felt the invisible fingers at the back of my mind awaken, howling like a feral cat that had been caged too long. I kept my distance.
Lee,
I'm okay. Go back to the van.
Again with a forced, bright voice. He dropped to a crouch, then completely to the ground. But I didn't move, not until he leaned forward and stuck his head between his knees, looking like he was about to throw up everything in his stomach. I stared long and hard at the place where his light hair curled against his neck, at the exact spot an old bruise disappeared down his shirt collar. My hand lifted at my side to push the soft fabric away. I wanted to see how far the ugly mark extended, to see what other old wounds he was hiding.
You touched him before. A little voice whispered at the back of my mind, and nothing happened then.
Instead, I took a step back and away, so I was no longer standing directly behind him, but off to the side.
Distance.
Distance was good.
You're right, you know,
he said quietly.
I don't want to find the slip kid just to deliver Jack's letter.
I don't even want to use him to help me find my family. I know where they are and how to reach them, but I can't go home.
Not yet.
Somewhere behind us, I heard one of Betty's doors slide open, but it didn't break the stillness of the moment.
Why not? I'm sure your parents miss you.
Liam rested his arms over his knees, his back still to me.
Did Chubbs tell you? Did he say anything to you about me and the League?
He couldn't see it, but I still shook my head.
Harry, my stepdad, he knew from the start that the Children's League was bad news.
Said they would use us worse than Gray ever would, and wouldn't shed one damn tear if we died helping them. Even after Claire. Claire was my little sister. He cleared his throat. Even after she was gone, he used to remind me that no amount of fighting was ever going to bring her back. Cole had already joined up with them, and he came back to get me to go with him. To fight. Was my sister. Was gone. Another victim of IAAN. I bought into it. I was so angry, and I hated everyone and everything. But there wasn't anyone to direct it at. I was there with them for weeks, training, letting them turn me into this weapon, into the kind of person that would take an innocent person's life just because it served their needs and what they wanted. My brother was like a stranger. He even kept this thing he called a kill chart in our room. And he'd add to it every time he killed someone important. Every time he completed a mission. And I would come in after training all day, and I'd look at it and think, how many of those people had families? And how many of those people had people who needed them like we needed Claire? And that's just it. They all did, Ruby. I'm sure of it. People don't live like islands. So you got out. He nodded. Had to run during a training simulation outside. I was trying to get back to Harry and Mom when the PSFs picked me up. He finally turned so he was looking at me. I can't go back to them yet. Not until I earn it. Not until I make it right. What are you talking about? While I was with the League, I realized that the only people that were ever going to help us were ourselves. So when I figured out a way to break out of Caledonia... Liam's voice trailed off. Then he said, it was horrible. Horrible. I totally failed them, even after I promised it would work out in the end. So why... His voice caught. You heard what that newscaster said. Only a few of us got out, so they just keep picking us off like rabbits in hunting season. So why do I want to do it again? Why can't I shake it? All I want is to help more kids break out of Caledonia, out of Thurmond, out of every single camp, one by one. Oh, I thought, feeling vaguely numb. Oh. I had only ever wanted to find the slip kid to help myself, to figure out how to tame my abilities. But all along, Liam had wanted to find him because he was sure he'd be able to help others. That, together, they could figure out a way to save the kids we'd all been forced to leave behind. It's just so unfair, you know? All this morning I kept thinking, it's so goddamned unfair that I'm here, so close to finding East River, and the rest of them are gone. He pressed the back of his hand to his eyes. It makes me feel sick. I can't shake it. I can't. Those kids they were talking about on the radio, I'm sure they were from Caledonia. He took in a ragged breath. Do you think they regret following me? Not for a second, I said. Listen to me. You didn't force them to follow you. You only gave them what the PSFs and camp controllers took away from them. A choice. You can't live in a place like those camps and not know what the consequences might be. If those kids followed you out, it was because they chose to. They believed you when you said we'd all get home someday. But most of them didn't. Liam shook his head. In some ways, it would have been safer for them to stay in the camps, right? They wouldn't have been hunted. They wouldn't have had to see how afraid everyone is of them or felt like they don't have a place out here. But isn't it better to give them that choice? I asked. Is it? My head was pounding and my shoulders ached. By the time I finally thought of something to say, Liam was climbing up onto his knees. What are you still doing here? Not upset or angry? Not anymore. Watching your back? He shook his head, a sad smile on his face. You've got better things to worry about. I'm really sorry. The words tumbled out of me in a breathless rush. I shouldn't have opened his letter. It was none of my business. I wasn't thinking. No. No, I'm the one that's sorry.
I didn't mean to blow up at you. God, it was like Dad was talking through me. I'm so, so sorry.
Liam looked down, and when he looked back at me, his lips were pressed tight together. I thought he might cry or scream, and felt myself sway forward at the same time he took another dangerous step toward me. It made me feel boneless to meet his gaze straight on, but I wanted the truth from him, even as I worried the intensity of his gaze would burn me.
Come on, let's go back.
He shook his head.
I'm fine. I shouldn't have left those two alone again.
I think you need another minute, I said, and I think you should take it, because when you get back in that car, you'll have people depending on you. He tried to reach for my arm, but I took a step back.
I don't know what you're...
he began. God, I wanted to take his hand when he offered it. Mine were frozen, needled with pain. Here, I motioned between us. This is a place where you don't need to lie. I meant what I said before, but I can't help you if you don't tell me what's really going on inside your head. If you need to talk or vent or scream, do it with me. Don't just get up and go like that again, like you always do. I know you think you're protecting us, but Lee, what happens if one of these days you go off and don't come back?
He took a step toward me, his eyes darkening with something I didn't recognize. It never occurred to me how tall he was, but he seemed to tower over me then, leaning down until our faces were level with each other. I could see what I would have done if our situation had been different, if I had been in control of myself. I could see what he wanted. What I wanted.
My foot slipped against a rock as I stepped away, my back scraping against the wall, my head sending me spiraling into panic. It was trilling in anticipation, relishing how close he was. Maybe his anger had evaporated, but whatever he was feeling now was stronger than before, stronger than pain or frustration or fury. The words, "get away from me," and "don't," were stuck in my tight chest, wedged between terror and want. Liam's lips formed my name, but there was nothing outside of the blood rushing in my ears. I tried one last time to wrench myself away, but my knees, the traitors, buckled under me. Spots in every shade of the rainbow popped and burst in front of my eyes. And that's when he grabbed me. Only this time, it was to hold me up, not pull me to him. It didn't matter. The moment his hands circled my waist, he was gone.
18. My eyes were shut, but I could imagine what must have happened, how his pupils must have shrunk and then dilated, open and vulnerable, waiting for a command. Liam's mind was a blur of colors and lights. One moment I was standing next to a young blonde boy in overalls, clutching a woman's hand. Then I was balancing on the front bumper of an old car as a gentle-faced man with strong arms pointed out the engine. I saw the face of a kid rocket back as I punched him in the nose, heard a roar of approval from a circle of boys formed around us. I stared at Chubb's long legs as they hung over the edge of the top bunk, and then I was standing in front of Black Betty, watching Zoo climb into the back seat, looking frail and hungry. And then I was seeing me. I was seeing me with the sunlight reflecting off my dark hair, laughing my fool head off in the passenger seat. I didn't know I could look like that.
No. No, no, I don't want to see... I slapped him across the face. The sound echoed up through the tree branches. Pain flared in my hand, spreading quickly up my arm to the center of my chest. I heard something else, too. A snap. Like a dried-out wishbone being pulled apart. I reeled back, as if he had been the one to hit me. I almost wished he had, because the pain would have distracted me from the dizzy disorientation that came next. I panicked. I knew from countless experiences at Thurmond that the best way to break a connection was to do it slowly, carefully, unravel the invisible threads linking us together one by one. Wasn't this exactly what had happened with Sam? One wrong touch, and I had pulled back so hard and so fast from her mind that I ripped away every single trace of me. Wasn't it? Wasn't it? The pain lessened the farther I dragged myself away from him. Ruby?
Why did I always have to do this? Why couldn't I just hold it together for once?
Liam was staring at me.
At me, not through me. He looked focused, if not completely bewildered. My eyes fell on the red welt forming on his cheek. Had I heard that right? My name?
What the hell just happened?
He let out a strangled laugh.
I feel like I just got hit by a linebacker.
I slipped. What could I possibly say? The truth was on the tip of my tongue, dangling there. But if he knew what I had just done to him...
And there I was, trying to be all valiant and stuff by catching you?
He chuckled, using the closest tree to help him stand.
Lesson learned. You're falling next time, darling, because, man, you have a hard head.
I'm sorry, I whispered. I'm so, so sorry. Liam stopped laughing.
Green, you know I'm just kidding, right?
Really, it takes a special kind of guy to get knocked out by the same person he's trying to catch. Aside from bringing back a few humiliating memories of school sports, I'm fine, honestly.
What?
Do you even remember what we were talking about?
Oh my God, he said, all of a sudden noticing I was still on the ground. Are you okay? I can't believe I didn't even ask. Are you hurt?
I avoided the hand he offered. It was too soon.
I'm fine, I said. I think we should head back now. You left Betty running.
My voice sounded calm, but inwardly, I was such a desert. All of the hope that had sprung there, growing and spreading and yielding like a stream, had dried up in an instant. I had slipped up, but he didn't know. They never did.
This couldn't happen again. I was lucky this time. He still remembered me, even if he couldn't recall what I had done. But there was no guaranteeing that luck would hold.
No more touching. No more fingers brushing against arms or shoulders pressed against shoulders. No more taking his hand, no matter how warm or big it was. That alone was a reason to find this slip kid, to beg him to help me.
Yeah. Yeah.
He nodded, but I didn't miss the way his brows furrowed when he looked my way again, or the grinding ache in my chest when he passed by and didn't let his hand reach for mine. I stayed 5 steps in front of him as we made our way back around the rest stop, past the water fountains, through the silver benches and tables under the overhang. I moved faster, practically jogging as I came around the corner. I half expected to see Chubbs and Zoo outside trying to rig the vending machines into burping up whatever snacks they had left. But it wasn't Chubbs waiting there for me, and it certainly wasn't Zoo. Dark hair, darker eyes, a man that couldn't have been older than 25, with a scar that began just under his right eye and raced up to his hairline, where the shiny pink skin had prevented any hair from growing back. My brain processed his features one by one in agonizing slowness. I watched as his face twisted, turning his narrow nose up in disgust. Liam called my name in a panic, his feet thundering against the cement.
Run! I wanted to scream to him. What are you doing? Run!
I turned back to face the man, the skip tracer, in his wrinkled blue windbreaker, just in time to see the butt of his rifle flying down toward my face, knocking every thought clear out of my skull. Pain blinded me, flashing white beneath my eyelids. But I was down, not out. When the man tried to haul me up by the front of my shirt, I swung a leg around and caught him by the ankles. He landed on the ground with a grunt, his gun clattering against a nearby patch of rocks. I kicked until I made contact with something solid. I knew it wasn't enough. I tried pushing myself up to my feet, but the world swung wild and loose under me. My head throbbed, and something hot and wet poured down over my right eye. Blood. I could taste it then, just as plainly as I felt the air move as Liam lifted the man clear off the ground with a wave of his hand. He threw him like a rag doll into the sharp edges of the picnic tables, knocking the skip tracer out in a single blow.
Zoo. Chubbs. Zoo. Chubbs.
My mind was stuck on a loop. I pressed a hand against my forehead, to the place where the gun had burst the skin in a jagged line. I don't know what happened next. It felt like my head was skipping seconds as we moved. At one point, I think Liam must have tried to help me up, but I pushed him away with clumsy, slow hands. "Run," I tried to say. "Get out of here."